come is the only hymn that he ever mentions in any of his writings. It's in The Magician's Nephew, one of his Chronicles of Narnia books. The only one. So I'm so glad you were able to do that one. So thank you all for being here. It's going to be a little bit different this morning. I'm getting old and cranky in my dotage, and I've learned that with sermons now, a good sermon makes you think, a great sermon makes you think about something you haven't thought about before. That's my opinion. Now, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to intertwine the story of C.S. Lewis with my own story a little bit. I hope you'll indulge me. But the goal is really to get each one of you to think about your own conversion. When it was that you decided that you really wanted your life to be part of the following of Christ. Because C.S. Lewis is very much instrumental in why I'm in this church today. And I'd like you to be thinking as I'm talking about what led you to be sitting in this church today. So we'll start off. Here is C.S. Lewis. He lived from 1898 to 1963. This was the book that first brought me to the knowledge of C.S. Lewis. You may or may not have heard of this. It's actually his autobiography. You know, God knows how each one of us need to be spoken to. And I really think different personalities and different learning types are going to approach this from a completely different area. What may work for Joe or Milton may absolutely not work for me. We can't follow a strict line of how it is we're supposed to be converted. And those of us that came into adulthood in the 70s and 80s will remember the Born Again, Chuck Colson's book, Born Again. And I can remember feeling like a complete fraud with that whole experience there, because many of you grew up in Christian homes where you heard this term all of the time. I did not grow up in an overtly Christian home. My mother came from a Quaker background and certainly lived her Quaker values. And we attended a church, not on Sunday. She and I would go on Wednesday mornings. And it was the only time I was alone with my mother, because we had a large house that was always full of people. So I sometimes think my approach to God was formed in this way. But many of you grew up in homes that were Christian from the very beginning. So the idea of a born-again experience, how many of you remember people saying, I became a Christian on March 5th, 1973 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? I had a lot of friends like that. Some of you, I'm sure, can remember that. And I would smile and nod and think, oh my gosh, I'm not a Christian. I can't pick a date out of the air. I can't identify. For me, it was more of a sunrise rather than a black and white change. So C.S. Lewis was very much a part of that. So when I was 23 years old, I was given this book by a neighbor because she knew I was really searching. And I was alone a lot, because my late husband was a pilot in the Air Force, and he was gone quite often. So I had lots of time to read. And God knew this. And so I feel as if my conversion very much came about through reading. Through reading. I'd be very interested to hear how it came about for each of you as well. So we'll start with C.S. Lewis. He is from Belfast, which is about where the N is in United Kingdom. He's Irish. By birth and by lineage, he was Irish, and when he was born, it was one Ireland. It was not a Northern Ireland. As you can see, there's a border there. This area of Ireland is now part of the United Kingdom. And I will mention this also, I have close family that live in Belfast, and Russell and I have been there and visited them. And I was thrilled to discover that my cousin's home is about two blocks from C.S. Lewis's home. I couldn't believe it. This is the home that he grew up in, called Little Lee. In Great Britain, they put these blue discs outside buildings where somebody famous lived. And it's very interesting, because as you drive around London, you'll see these on the sides of buildings all over the place. You can't stop and look at them all, but it's amazing how many interesting people have lived in various places. He is very much a product of his home. He mentions it. He said, I am the product of large attics and empty rooms and many books. He was one of two little boys that grew up in this large home. His father was a solicitor or an attorney. This is a picture of his family. As I said, it was the two boys. His mother, unusually for the time, had a degree in mathematics, so she was a very brilliant woman also. Russell said, "Don't get bogged down in what color suit he wore. I'm going to try and avoid that." You know when you get someone talking about something they're fascinated by and they get into the minutia and you're just glazing over? If I see you start to glaze over, I promise I'll continue on quickly. This is his mother, Flora. And the great tragedy of his life is that his mother died when he was about 10. And in those days, you know, they didn't discuss death. The person basically disappeared. He was never told his mother was dying. One evening she died. And it was a profound effect on the rest of his life. And his poor father, who I sympathize with, did not know how to handle it. So what he did is he sent both boys off to boarding school 2 weeks after their mother died. And C.S. Lewis hated boarding school. You know, it's very much a part of the British system. They were sent to England. Many of you may have seen movies where there's these boys' schools. It's all about sports and jolly boy times, and he hated all of that. He just wanted to sit and read. He hated sports. He was in complete misery in his board. As a matter of fact, he goes to the front in World War I, but if you read his autobiography, you'd think that boarding school was far worse than being in the trenches of World War I. This is his father with the two brothers. He was very close to his brother Warner, who was 3 years older his entire life. They lived together through much of their adult life. C.S. Lewis is in the middle of this photograph. We always see him as sort of a round man, an older man when he's shown, but this is him as a young man. Unfortunately for him, he was coming into his young manhood at between the years of 1914 and 1918. Now, because he was an Irish citizen, he was not obligated to serve in the British Army during World War I. In other words, he was not going to be drafted. It was only volunteers that came, but he did volunteer. So he went to Oxford, was there for a few months to study, and then was sent, joined the Officer Training Corps, and was sent to France. Oxford is where he's going to spend the rest of his adult life, for the most part. He arrived when he was 17. He arrived on the Western Front on his 19th birthday. And with the exception of going to France for the time that he spent in the military, almost everything else we're going to talk about will be taking place in Oxford, which is where I was just 2 weeks ago. So there's no way to describe it. It is a magical place. Fortunately, during World War II, Hitler had decided that Oxford was going to be the center of learning for his new Reich, so Oxford was never bombed. It was specifically taken off any list for bombing, so it looks just as it did. It was founded in 1096, I think. He goes to World War I. There's no way to begin to describe what World War I was like. It was, I think personally, the worst war ever fought, because you had almost medieval military technique coming up against 20th century military technique. You had men on horseback riding into machine guns. It was horrific. It killed millions and millions of people, and it was especially a war that brought the war to civilians. Up until this point, warfare was meant to be battles between armies. World War I took it into villages, towns, and cities. It was absolutely horrific, and the suffering that these men endured, I can't even imagine. I can't imagine. This is C.S. Lewis as a young soldier. He was lucky enough to be taken off the front twice. Once he had trench fever, where he was allowed to convalesce for about 5 weeks and read books. The second injury, he actually was hit by shrapnel that killed the man standing next to him. And what's difficult to read is how many beautiful, young, brilliant men died in World War I that could have changed the course of the 20th century, but they weren't there left to change the course of history. That the shell that killed the man standing next to him could have just as easily killed C.S. Lewis if it had just been a few inches off, and we wouldn't be having this conversation now. But it makes you wonder, who did we never hear from? Who never came out of that war? He then returns to Oxford. 1096. This always makes me smile because our country is about to celebrate its 250th anniversary. And I promise you, I went into bathrooms that were older than our country in Oxford by hundreds of years. One thing that I've just kind of an interesting, this is what people wear in Oxford now when they're taking their exams or when they're beginning their courses. So every time you see anyone graduate from high school or college in this country where they wear the long gowns, all of those come from Oxford University, the gowns that you wear, because they were monastic or they were originally Oxford was created purely to educate the clergy. So what you're seeing are basically vestments. And so if you go to a high school graduation at Tab High School, you're actually seeing this descendant of these. Of course, there were no women at Oxford until relatively recently. This is the house that he bought with his brother, Warney. It was about a mile and a half from the university. He walked there every day. I spent some time in there. It was a very typical bachelor pad in the worst possible way. They both smoked heavily. When people went to visit, they talked about how there was nicotine everywhere. And one lady went to visit in the mid-1950s, and they had taken their World War I blankets and used them as curtains for the blackout during World War II. They hadn't taken them down. I can't even imagine what the place must have smelled like. It would have been horrific. Now, this is his church. This is the only picture I'm going to show you for my trip, so don't worry. It's not going to be a travelogue. This is my friend that I went with, who I've known since seventh grade. This is C.S. Lewis's pew in this little church. And what made me smile is it's the pew that's up against the pillar off to the side so nobody can sit by them. So they didn't have to go. He was very non-denominational. He said, go to the closest church to where you live. It doesn't matter. What your denomination was irrelevant to him. He said, it's a big, you know, we have many mansions, right, in Scripture. He would have never told anybody to go to one church or another. He went to the Church of England because it happened to be the most common denomination. It happened to be the one that was near his home. He had a friendship that changed everything. So I forgot to mention something really important, which was that C.S. Lewis was a very committed atheist. He had gone through the Sunday school sort of program of the Church of Ireland, where he grew up. But at age 14, he decided it was all tosh. And he said one of the greatest mistakes he made was to be confirmed when he didn't believe. He said he regretted it the rest of his life. But he was very much an atheist. He just didn't think any of it made sense at all. And then, as he became an adult, he developed a friendship with J.R.R. Tolkien, who, as you all know, wrote Lord of the Rings and is more famous today than he has ever been. He only gets more and more famous as time goes on. Tolkien was a devout Catholic and a very committed Christian and had a huge influence on C.S. Lewis's spiritual journey. And what I love about C.S. Lewis is that he can point to certain books that converted him. It was a combination of his reading and his friendship that brought him to Christ. He became a believer in God before he became a believer in Jesus. It was two separate events, two separate occurrences. So he went from total atheism to believing there had to be a divine creator, but it took a while more. It took a long walk, one long night, with J.R.R. Tolkien and one other man. They walked back and forth on a path by their college, and then that converted him, that made him realize that Christ really was the truth. And by the way, J.R.R. Tolkien had a son named Christopher, who was my cousin Sean's tutor at Oxford, so that means J.R.R. Tolkien and I are like this. We're practically related. Which means I'm practically related to C.S. Lewis because they were friends. So I will take any reflected glory that's available. Of course, I never met either one of them. He did develop a group called the Inklings. Now, this was a group of scholars, other professors at Oxford, that would gather once a week and they would read each other their papers and they would discuss what was important to them. They met for decades and it was a great group of very bright men who could throw ideas off of each other. How lucky they were to have this. How lucky would we all be if we had a group of people that would challenge you on what your beliefs or what you were saying. They didn't let anybody slide through. And this was very formative for C.S. Lewis's his writing and his philosophy. By the way, Tolkien couldn't stand Narnia. He said, do not print this. You're only going to embarrass yourself. So it just shows you can be wrong about certain things. This is the group of the Inklings, and I won't bore you with the details about it. If you want to talk to me about it afterwards, please do. They met at a pub called the Eagle and Child. Russell and I got to go sit in the very table where they would gather. And then World War II came along. So up to this point, C.S. Lewis has just been a quiet don, that's what they would call an instructor at Oxford, quietly doing his academic work. He specialized in medieval literature. We would have never heard of him, except he became known enough for a couple of his writings by somebody that worked at the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. World War II was a hugely, it's the event that changed the life of him definitely forever, because they were looking for people that could go onto the radio and talk about faith. London was being completely bombed by the Blitz. It was a terrifying time. And so he was invited by the director of the BBC to come to London four times and give a talk on faith. And he did it. And they recorded these talks. And they were so popular that they decided to write them out and release them in a book form. And Mere Christianity, which some of you have heard and some of you have probably read, is actually the written words of these four talks that he delivered during the darkest hours during World War II. And I want you to keep that in mind, because very much his view on a lot of Christianity comes from this war, these two wartime experiences. And one thing that he said that really I have often thought when coming into any church, and I'm about to hear somebody speak, he said, when we gather together, we are part of the underground, and we are getting a message from headquarters about how we are supposed to be in this wartime situation. And I've often thought, isn't that really what we are supposed to be? We are supposed to be different than what's going on outside of this building. I loved that image that we are part of an underground community that is trying to bring change about. And I first heard that from Mere Christianity. This was the second book that I read after Surprised by Joy. And because I needed to be convicted up here and hoped that it got to here, it was this book that absolutely helped me with that in a huge way. Hardship often prepares an ordinary person for an extraordinary destiny. You can imagine what that meant to people who were watching their city crumble around them. Now, this is one, the next book. Both these books, Mere Christianity and the Screwtape Letters, came out during World War II. And I don't know how many of you have ever read Screwtape Letters. Okay, so then you know it is very much written with a wartime mentality, because, and you know, the other thing I have to always tell my students, I don't have to tell you because you're smart, but at the time they were writing these things, they didn't know if Great Britain was going to win the war. For all they knew, the Germans were going to win. The Germans were winning for a very long time. And there was absolutely an expectation that the Germans could have won World War II. So as they're writing, they're not writing from our perspective where we know how it's all going to end. If you've not read Screwtape Letters, I highly recommend it, because it makes you see things. It makes you analyze how you are behaving that is possibly because there's a little devil talking in your ear, and how small it can be. You know, I think when you're young, you think of evil as these grand, oh my gosh, homicide, horrible lying, things that we could all say, well, I never did that. But he brings it down to the kind of person that says, well, I just have to have my cup of tea just so. Why can't anybody make the cup of tea the way I like it made? And demanding that everybody make sure that they get their cup of tea the way that they like. That's the one that got me. I carry my own tea bags with me at all times in case you need an emergency cup of tea. You know, so that it's as if you have to, the idea of these little bits of egotism that from the outside may not look bad, but actually are terribly narcissistic and self-absorbed. I learned to just start drinking lousy cups of tea and just smile. Everybody, we all have to, I'm not going to live through the, well, who knows, not living through the Blitz, but I can make up that one. So the Screwtape Letters became an enormous bestseller. Once again, this is all in around 1944. Stephen. To the point where he was on the cover of Time magazine. So that should show you how truly he became quite the celebrity. It didn't change his lifestyle at all, and nobody at Oxford, his colleagues, it actually kind of hurt his reputation, because Oxford wanted scholars. They did not want popular writers. So in some ways, it was damaging to him. But if you can see in this picture, there's a devil over the corner of C.S. Lewis. It's on his shoulder. It's a devil. So this cover was as a result of Screwtape Letters being so very popular. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. That is one of my favorite quotes of C.S. Lewis. So now we're in the 1940s. His brother, Warney, who was a terrible alcoholic, he had gone to Sandhurst, which is the British equivalent of West Point. He had a career in the military. Eventually, he had to leave the military because he had a terrible drinking problem. But they loved each other very much. And so the two brothers, after the war, Warney moves in full time, and they're living together at the house that I showed you earlier. I shouldn't have probably used this one. It says, Christianity, if false is of no importance, if true is of infinite importance, and the one thing it cannot be is moderately important. How many of us take Christianity and make it moderately important in our lives? I suspect more than we'd care to admit. It is in the early 1950s that he begins to write the book that probably most people are familiar with, because starting as a young person, The Chronicles of Narnia. How many of you have read The Chronicles of Narnia? How many of you read The Chronicles of Narnia as a young person? That's me as well. We have a young person over there. I did not read The Chronicles of Narnia until I was in my 20s, because the cover that was popular on this set in the 1970s looked like very much a children's book. I mean, a young children's book. The illustrations that you just walk, if you walk by a bookstore and saw it. I'm grateful now that I did not discover it till I was an adult, because I loved every single page. And is there anything more fun than reading the first book and realizing there are whole other bunches of books coming afterwards? That this is not going to be the only book, that there's seven volumes in the Chronicles of Narnia. And it was such a joy to discover this. If I find myself in desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. C.S. Lewis was the one writer that began to make me realize that I had a very provincial view of reality, that I was seeing reality in my own small little box. Those of you that have read The Chronicles of Narnia or seen the film know that they enter this magical world through a wardrobe, a big wooden chest with coats hanging in it. And it made you wonder, where are these portals that God has created for us to get glimpses of him in this world? I loved that analogy. And he had an old wardrobe up in the attic of his house in the Kilns, which now is in the library at Wheaton College. So if you ever get to go to Wheaton College, that is where the great C.S. Lewis library is, with all of his objects, because he became popular in the United States, far more popular than he was in England. As a matter of fact, when he died, his publisher said, we'll probably publish his books for another 2 to 3 years, and then we won't publish them anymore, because that's traditionally when an author's books fall out of fashion. I would love to have had the copyright on that. Then a surprise happened, which was he met a woman named Joy Davidman, and the way he met her is quite unusual. C.S. Lewis was a really generous, kind man, and as he became more famous, say starting in the mid-40s, he started getting lots of letters from people with spiritual questions, many letters, to the point where he had to spend 2 hours every morning responding to letters. And he once said that heaven would be a place where he'd never have to write another letter, because he felt it was very much an obligation to respond to these people, especially children, which was not. He wrote many letters to children. But this woman, who was a Jewish atheist and communist, and divorced, began writing him letters. She had had a Christian conversion experience. I think if you lined up a group of women and said, which one would you pick that is going to marry C.S. Lewis, she would have absolutely been the last you would have expected. So she developed a correspondence with him. She then came to England to meet him. They met, they became friends, and then she developed bone cancer. And she was not expected to live more than a couple of months. This is like in 1952. She wanted to be able to stay in England. She was an American citizen. So C.S. Lewis married her purely on paper so that she would have the legal right to remain in Great Britain and get medical care that she needed. And it was purely on paper. There was because it didn't count unless they were married in the church in C.S. Lewis's eyes. But legally, that's what happened. Over the course of her treatment, they began to genuinely fall in love. And she had what is said to be a miraculous recovery. Not a cure, but instead of dying in a matter of a few months, which was what was expected, she ended up living 3 to 4 more years. And after a year or so, they discovered that they were actually in love genuinely, and they had a church wedding. They were in her hospital room. They had an Anglican priest come and perform the wedding, and then they considered themselves genuinely married. And so that is a very interesting, you know, you want to have this idea. Everyone wants to think of him as this genial bachelor professor. But she entered his life, and she was very bright. She wrote a book about the Ten Commandments, and she really challenged him in an intellectual way. So by all accounts, they had a very happy marriage. And then, unfortunately, the bone cancer returned, and she died. And as a result of her death, he wrote a book about grief, A Grief Observed, which has been of enormous help to so many people who have suffered loss and grief. Because it even brought him to have a crisis of faith. So people could identify with this. I know when my late husband died, this book was absolutely so helpful to me, and I've met so many other people that this book has been tremendously helpful. If you ever meet someone who's struggling with grief and loss, I highly recommend the book, A Grief Observed. So she died, and then he sort of became responsible for these two sons of hers, which is another story. This is a picture of them in their garden. And this is the book. So I would say, of the books of C.S. Lewis that have had such an effect on me, this would be the fourth one. I tried to read it in my 20s because, you know, when you discover an author, you want to read everything they've ever written. It did nothing for me in my 20s. I was not at a point in my life where this book would have spoken to me in any way. But it definitely spoke to me when I was 60 and going through this loss. There are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, in the end, thy will be done. I've spent my life, or my will be done. It's supposed to say, those who say to God, thy will be done, but they really mean my will being done. How much of your life have you spent with your own will being done? Now, many people never knew that C.S. Lewis had died, because he actually died at the same hour as John F. Kennedy's assassination. Now, think of that. Do you think that the death of an author in England would have been even in the newspaper when that had just happened? So lots of people thought he was alive long after he had died. They just were shocked to discover that he died. The sad thing is, he was only 64 when he died. And not that 64 is a teenager, it's getting younger by the minute, but 64, I think about many other writers, if he could have easily had 20 more years of writing. It's kind of like Mozart dying at 34, and you realize, what music will we never hear, because he died so young. Actually, when you read about C.S. Lewis's lifestyle, I think it's a miracle he made it to 64. Because he loved to eat, he loved to drink, and he smoked unbelievable amounts. But he walked 2 to 6 miles, he walked all the time. He didn't own a car, he never learned to drive. So he walked everywhere. I think he got 6 to 64 because he walked everywhere. That would be my guess on that. So that's the day he died, and as I said, at the same hour. This is another thing that taught me. He very much was opposed to the idea that as we go on, we become so much smarter than those that came before us. so much holier than those that came before us, that we're evolving in a way that makes us just better than the generations before. He said, it's not that we're any smarter, it's that we've had people go before us whose shoulders we are standing on. So he said, we are dwarves perched on the shoulders of giants, was a quote that he loved, because he said, you can choose to be down on the ground. You can choose not to read these people, not to study these people, and you'll see the world in a certain way. But why would you do that when you can stand on the shoulders of all of this wisdom and see the world in the way that it could be presented? So I love to think of myself as a dwarf attempting to see from the shoulders of giants like C.S. Lewis. And I would love to hear from you afterwards if you have an author or a writer that was very much instrumental in your own path, in what made you a Christian. Some people don't need books. Some people have such good, tender hearts that it just goes directly into their heart like an arrow. And I used to envy those people so much because it felt as if they just got it so much more easily than I did. It's like I had to be convinced with someone pounding a book over the top of my thick skull for it to seep in. And you're never too old to set a new goal or to dream a new dream. I liked that one also. So I am just grateful to C.S. Lewis. I'm grateful that I was asked to give this talk about him because I think he is a marvelous person for all of us to read and that he can speak to people in different ways. Questions? Yes. If anybody has, I should have said that at the beginning. If any of you have questions, I would be happy to answer any of them right now. And I'd be happy to hear if any of you have to say if you had a book that really spoke to you. Does anybody have something like that that they, yes? How old was he? He would have been in his 30s. In his 30s. He became a Christian in 1931, and he died in, so he would have been late 20s, early 30s. Yes? Yes. Yes, Henry Nouwen, if you didn't hear. Henry Nouwen is a wonderful writer. I know Russell is very fond of Henry Nouwen. He was a Catholic priest, and he has a way of writing that just cuts through everything. You know, I hesitate, thank you so much for bringing him up, to recommend C.S. Lewis to everybody, because there are going to be people that are going to read this and think, ugh, you know, it just does not speak to me. He was an academic. And although he was trying to write to a broader audience, you can't totally take the academician out of the writing sometimes. Henry Nouwen had a very gentle, wonderful way of writing. Also someone that died too young. He had a heart attack and died, I think, at age 60. So many more things he could have written. But he's wonderful. Does anybody else have a writer that they loved? Because maybe somebody will pick up Henry Nouwen. Richard Rohr. A Franciscan priest, I think, who also has been very helpful to many, many people. I know my children have liked Richard Rohr, so he's speaking to a whole new generation. Anyone else have any thoughts on what has been helpful to them? You know, I look at Samantha, and I think she may have been brought into faith a lot because of music, because of the beauty of music, at which she shares with us then. I guess what was helpful to me about him is it broke me out of that idea that I had to look and sound like all my friends who'd read Born Again by Charles Colson and that's the path that you had to follow. Because I felt like a fraud. Because I was presenting myself as a Christian, but I felt like I had to make sure I was saying all the right words and using the right language, and it wasn't coming naturally at all. So, well, once again, I love hearing how people came to Christ. I think it is the most interesting conversation. Whether you're like Russell and were raised in a very devout home and never really struggled with it, or you grew up with absolutely nothing and it came to you out of the blue, I think every story is so beautiful and so valid. And I thank you for letting me share a little bit with you today.